VOA News, I'm Gene Randall. There has been pushback from Saudi Arabia to U.S. President Donald Trump's threat of severe punishment if the kingdom is found to be guilty of foul play in the disappearance of Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Ben Thomas has a report from Washington.
In an official statement read on government-run TV, Saudi Arabia says threats of economic sanctions, political pressure, or the repeating of false accusations will not undermine the kingdom or its position in the world. It's vowing to respond with greater action to any attempt to punish it, noting the kingdom's economy has an influential and vital role in the global economy. The comments follow remarks by President Trump that Saudi Arabia could face severe punishment. At the White House Saturday, he told reporters,
"Let's determine what happened first. There's plenty of things we can do that are very tough."
However, he noted he would oppose the cancellation of arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Pope Francis has raised two controversial figures to sainthood. Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero and Pope Paul VI. Romero was gunned down by right-wing death squads while celebrating Mass in an El Salvador hospital chapel in 1980. Romero was known as the voice for those without a voice. Efforts to make him a saint over the years were held up by unease over his liberation theology. Pope Paul VI presided over the reforms of the Second Vatican Council that modernized the Catholic Church. Malaysia's former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has taken an important step toward his aim of moving into the Prime Minister's position if 93-year-old Mahathir Mohamad makes good on his pledge to resign in 2 years. The 71-year-old Ibrahim this weekend won a seat in the Malaysian Parliament. The two men earlier this year teamed up to defeat Najib Razak and the ruling coalition. This is VOA News. Cleanup and recovery efforts continue in areas ravaged by Hurricane Michael. For people still trapped in their homes, help cannot come fast enough. One team of volunteers is trying to change that with a chainsaw and water. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from the Florida panhandle town of Panama City.
Johnny Gonzalez is on a mission.
Now we've been traveling around here for about 4 days now.
To get to the homes unreachable because of what Hurricane Michael left behind.
When I needed help, they come and rescue me. They sacrificed their life for me. And now I'm going to sacrifice mine for my town people.
He and his family made it home, but the situation was not good. He called his boss, Lee Nettles, for help.
We had a call from him, just a voicemail that all he heard was, "We were trapped and we need water, help." So Amanda said, "I'm going to get him." And I said, "Okay, I'm going with you." And we found him and his wife and his two kids.
The two men and their coworker, Amanda Miles, decided to hit the road and offer help to others. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Panama City, Florida.
A medical charity is calling for the immediate evacuation of all refugees and asylum seekers from the island nation of Nauru and an end to Australia's controversial offshore detention policy. Staff from Médecins Sans Frontières were forced to leave the Pacific Island this week. From Sydney, here is Phil Mercer.
Nauru's government says it can meet the mental health needs of residents as well as refugees and asylum seekers detained in an Australian-run immigration facility. The camp has been used to hold unauthorised migrants caught trying to reach Australia by boat. On Friday, the Nauru government told Médecins Sans Frontières staff that they had to leave the island. In response, the medical charity says it's concerned for the more than 100 asylum seekers and refugee children on Nauru, citing fears about post-traumatic stress, attempted suicide and self-harm. Canberra argues that offshore processing is a powerful deterrent for migrants risking their lives at sea. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The World Bank says it will send financial aid to Indonesia to help in the recovery from last month's earthquake and tsunami, which killed more than 2,000 people in the coastal city of Palu. Describing Indonesians as resilient and compassionate, World Bank President Yam Jim Kim said the bank would meet that compassion by sending up to $1 billion in recovery and rehabilitation aid. More than 80,000 people in the devastated areas are still displaced. And another migrant caravan of more than 1,000 Honduran men, women, and children, including infants, is on its way through Mexico. Some wanting refugee status, others looking for U.S. visas. This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Other than making a direct price control pronouncement, they're not going to do that. There are still long queues in the market for fuel. You know, foreign currency is still not available in the official banking system.
Zimbabweans express concern about the economy as price of goods soar.
I don't see how or why our government really, where they're taking this backup information, where they're saying that Gandhi inspired or he fought for black African independence in Africa, really, there's no actual historical evidence.
Malawians signed petition to pressure the government to stop plans to erect a statue in honor of Mahatma Gandhi.
Nous savons par expérience que lorsque les enfants scolarisés apprennent et savent...
Bouyarak says children in school learn how to prevent getting Ebola, and when they go home, they promote regular hand washing with their families.
The UN Children's Fund reports majority of children living in Ebola-affected areas in Congo are returning to school. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabweans are expressing concern about the economy as the price of goods soar. Some blame Finance Minister Mthuli Nkobe's announcement of a tax increase on money transfer last week. The move was aimed at stabilizing the government's finances, but critics say the announcement has led to sharp increases in commodity prices and inflation. For more on the reaction of Zimbabweans about the economy, I reach political analyst Rejoice Ngwenya in the capital, Harare.
Economic fundamentals that have been tempered with for 30 years don't just mature overnight. The problem is that the industrialists and the government are sending out conflicting signals. While the government is saying Mnangagwa's efforts of attracting investment are yielding fruits, there are new companies that are opening up. The private sector analysts say there are companies that are closing and unemployment is still relatively high. So really, to say that the economy is performing based on the propositions of the new government is not necessarily correct. But things are not necessarily as bad as they seem. And I've got a good reason for that. Because when the monetary policy statement was pronounced, Zimbabweans pressed a panic button. You know, our ego and market self-esteem has been damaged for a long time. So it's understandable why people normally panic. But obviously, the economy is not as well as it should be performing.
Well, some people on various social media platforms blame Finance Minister Nkobe's decision to introduce a tax increase on money transfers last week to try to stabilize the government's finances. What is your reaction to this?
The first time that I heard that point was to clarify to some economists and analysts that it is the responsibility of the Minister of Finance to raise government revenue. I mean, he has already put a disclaimer that he's not happy with the budget deficit, he's not happy with the way the government is spending money. But in his introductory statement, he mentioned that our economy is almost 60 to 70% informal. So there's huge volumes of money moving around our economy in the informal market. And he, as a professor of economics, must have figured out the best way of catching this revenue is to tax conversion transactions. And I think there is no problem with that. This is why I'm saying that if this tax had been introduced in Uganda, Kenya, or South Africa, it would not have caused a problem. What is causing the problem is the way that Zimbabweans react to policy pronouncements. But as long as you can make a commitment that is going to convince this government to stop spending money that it doesn't have, I personally have no problem with an innovative way of raising revenue.
Well, Rejoice, President Emmerson Mnangagwa is on record as saying that Zimbabwe is open for business. Some of his supporters are saying that his decision to open up Zimbabwe is attracting direct foreign investors who are coming in, setting up businesses and employing Zimbabweans. Are you seeing any visible signs of this happening in Zimbabwe?
The short answer is no. Why? Because if you are on a trajectory of attracting foreign investment. You know, there's a difference between having positive political and economic pronouncement and statement than actually having the actual investment coming in itself. What I can say for the time being, there is a positive vibe around the issue of an environment that is conducive to do business. But the average person in the street, I can assure you, there is nothing that he or she is going to see as a result of these positive statements. So, unfortunately, the signals are still in the negative zone, in the negative unemployment. Inflationary pressure is very high because of our over-reliance on imports, and the foreign exchange market is completely distorted.
Rejoice, is the government giving any assurances about this sudden shock, although some people believe it will be minimal? Is the government giving any assurances to the Zimbabwean to have confidence that its economic management will soon improve the performance of the economy?
Well, the government inevitably is going to come in and start talking about having signed a deal with Afreximbank Bank to ensure that they stabilize the one-to-one value rating between the RTGS and the US dollar. But, you know, like I said before, these are market shocks that are beyond anybody's control. So the government assurances tend to look very fallacious, because when the government says they are going to be stabilizing prices, it's not going to happen. In a free market economy, a government, other than making a direct price control pronouncement, they're not going to do that. There are still long queues in the market for fuel. You know, foreign currency is still not available in the official banking system. But they are making assurances that they want to make sure that there is sufficient foreign currency available to support RTGS transactions and imports of crucial commodities.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Malawians are signing an online petition to pressure the government to halt plans to erect a statue in honor of Mahatma Gandhi. Organizers of the petition contend that Gandhi, the anti-colonial campaigner, was a racist who does not deserve a national monument. They have been backed by former Vice President Kasim Chilumpa, who agrees with their views of the former Indian leader. But the government says the statue will recognize Gandhi's role in the fight against colonialism in India and Africa. For more reaction, I reach Impambila Kambewa, one of the organizers of the campaign against building of the proposed memorial.
This is a petition against the erection of the statue of Mahatma Gandhi, in which most citizens of the Republic of Malawi are against it because of the legacy of the man himself. This man is a reputed racist, whereby there's a lot of publications in which he said a lot of racially motivated things against black people when he was a lawyer in South Africa, in colonial South Africa. So our petition, really, the main thing why we're against it is because of his legacy and his history as a bigotist and as a racist. And also, it also has to do with the way our government has handled the whole project. The nation wasn't consulted. There was no due diligence that was made. So in any case, really, this direction or the proposed direction of this statue does really bring a lot of questions.
In Pambila, the government says that the statue is aimed at recognizing Gandhi's role in the struggle against colonialism in both India and Africa. Shouldn't this be celebrated?
There is no historical evidence whatsoever that proves that Gandhi ever contributed to any fight for independence or freedom in Africa. Also, adding to that, when he was fighting for Indian rights in South Africa, he was doing it at the expense of the black African population in Africa. And also, several scholars have even gone as much as said that Gandhi even accelerated apartheid, because him pretty much promoting Indian rights at the expense of black Africans, he was really promoting the differences between races and one race being superior to the other. I don't see how or why our government really where they're taking this backup information, where they're saying that Gandhi inspired or he fought for black African independence in Africa. Really, there's no actual historical evidence to that fact.
Malawi currently enjoys very good diplomatic relations with India, and it is estimated that $10 million will be used in the construction of the Mahatma Gandhi Conference and Convention Center in the commercial capital, Blantyre, that will attract or create jobs for Malawians. Why are you opposed to this?
Suffice to say, and I want to be very clear about this, we are not against any development in our country. In fact, our country really is one of the poorest countries in the world. But whatever development, whatever partnership that comes to us should not come at the expense of our dignity, should not come to the expense of our pride as a people, as a nation. So really, if it is a development that is bringing into question our identity and our pride, our dignity as a nation, really, I don't think we have space for that in our country. We are coming from a history of colonialism, and right now what is happening is some things are becoming too familiar, too similar to what was happening back in the 50s and the 40s when colonialism was rampant.
How many people have so far signed on to your petition, and when do you plan on presenting this petition to the administration?
We have an online petition that is almost hitting 4,000 signatures right now as I'm speaking. In real time, the signatures keep on coming. And we also have a physical petition coming, which we want to use as a legal tool. And this one, we have about 500 signatures. But we want to expedite this one. And then by next week, maybe we shall have about 2,000 signatures. And we shall be announcing a date when we shall be presenting the petition to the Blantyre City Council, the authorities, and about next week. But for now, we are focusing on awareness raising and sensitizing the nation, because a very, very significant portion of our population are not aware of this development, of this project. So our efforts are really much into creating awareness and sensitization.
Mpambila Kambewa is one of the organizers of the campaign against building Gandhi's statue. He spoke with me from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre. In South Sudan, some Jonglei state residents say their relatives are being detained for months and some years without trial. Aluang Riak, a public attorney, says he has filed over 10 cases, including murder cases, but none of them has been heard in court. Dengai Deng has this report from Bor.
Bor resident Joseph Achek says his relatives have been in prison for 40 weeks without trial due to absence of justice. John Yalaleo, the president of Jonglei State High Court, who was presiding over his relative's case.
I don't really appreciate people serving more than one month in the prison, yet they are not convicted. It's a concern to almost everybody. Whoever the relatives is serving while he's not convicted is not really happy with that. And we appeal to the authority concerned that they should convict people before they are taken to prison.
Advocate Makuri Yola says he has two clients in prison who are also waiting for the absentee judge to appear.
I have a case of my client called Maud Moun Garantuj. I submitted the appeal in the absence of the judge or president of High Court with a stay of execution because my client is waiting in prisons, and if the court was there, maybe the court can decide whether you can consider the stay of execution and or you can dismiss it. It affects directly our client because justice delay justice denied.
Yola says forcing people to serve time is illegal because a suspect is supposed to be presumed innocent until he or she is found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, according to South Sudanese law. Jonglei Public Attorney Alung Riak says Judge Aleu has not shown up in court for a month now. He says detaining suspects indefinitely without trial violates their rights of access to justice.
We are the prosecutors of the government. We used to receive cases, including the cases relating to the murders and robbery. This case is supposed to be trialed by the High Court. From the date we refer the case to the court, they are supposed to be brought to the court next day to the court so that they can hear and then they can be trialed, either to be convicted or to be released. There is some cases he started, then he leave them and then he go to Juba. So now we have something like 8 cases waiting for him for trial as a murder cases.
Jonkuch Ju Jonkuch is the spokesman at the board-based advocacy group, Jonglei Institute for Peace, Democracy and Development.
Has it been stated in the Constitution of South Sudan, at Chapter 1, Article 19, that anyone accused of committing a crime should be tried within 24 hours? The right has been violated. The concerned authority should sit down and see the best way that they can help these people at the prison.
Justice Aleu says he left for Juba last month because the Chief Justice assigned him to work in Jonglei for 3 months, which he says he has done. Speaking by phone from Juba, Justice Aleu says he went to report to the Chief Justice after serving his 3 months in the Jonglei State Court system.
For reporting, because I'm being assigned for Jonglei State just for a mission of a special court for the month, and it's over. So I have to go back to my boss, the Chief Justice, and to report to him. And I get my report, and I'm working.
Justice Aleu says he does not know when or if he will ever return to Jonglei State. Riak says he will travel to Juba this week to find out what the National Judiciary is doing to replace Justice Aleu in the Jonglei State High Court. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Children's Fund reports the vast majority of children living in Ebola-affected areas of Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have returned to school, where they are taught ways to avoid infection. For viewing, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
School began 1 month ago in Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN Children's Fund says efforts to get children to return to school in Ebola-affected areas in conflict-ridden eastern DRC have been hugely successful. It says 80% are attending schools in Beni and Mabalako health zones. They are the epicenters of the current Ebola outbreak, which was declared August 1st in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. The latest World Health Organization report finds 207 cases of Ebola, including 130 deaths. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bourirac says the return of so many children to the classroom is encouraging. He says school provides the children who are living in an area of epidemic and conflict with a sense of normalcy. He says school offers them a protective environment.
Nous savons par expérience que lorsque les enfants scolarisés apprennent à savent
Bourirac says children in school learn how to prevent getting Ebola, and when they go home, they promote regular hand washing with their families. He says this helps avoid further spread of the disease in the community. UNICEF has identified more than 1,500 schools in the areas affected by the Ebola epidemic. Among them are 365 schools located in the high-risk epicenters of the outbreak. The agency has equipped these schools with hygiene and health equipment. Bouliarak says more than 3,500 teachers and school principals have received training on preventive measures for Ebola. He says more than 69,300 school children have received these Ebola prevention messages. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
No one knows why some babies are born prematurely, but some of the smallest premature babies weigh under 1,500 grams. These tiny babies, micropremies, cannot afford to lose any weight. At Children's National Medical Center in Washington, a team of specialists has come up with a plan to give these babies the best chance to thrive. VOA's Carol Pearson has more from Washington.
When Vanessa O'Hockham gave birth to her son, she was only 24 weeks pregnant. Vanessa was terrified. Her newborn, JC, weighed just a little more than 736 grams, or about 1.5 pounds.
I couldn't even change a diaper. I was so nervous and anxious. He just looked so frail. But the nurses were very supportive and encouraging.
O'Hockham and J.C. were lucky. J.C. was in the neonatal intensive care unit, the NICU, at Children's National Medical Center in Washington during the course of a nutritional study. A team of specialists at the NICU wanted to see if they could help J.C. and other small preterm babies boost their weight and improve their chances to thrive. Michelon Riordet is a healthcare administrator who leads the team.
Preemies in particular have a high incidence of malnutrition as well as poor development.
As Riordet explained, these micropreemies have so little body fat they can't afford to waste energy. Some are in blanketed incubators to encourage sleep so they don't move around and burn calories. The team focused on what and when the babies ate. Caitlin Forsyth is the lead nurse on the study.
We noticed that a lot of our practitioners and the way that they were providing feedings for our very low birth weight babies, so those are babies that were born 1,500 grams or less, they're being fed all kinds of different varying ways.
The team wanted to standardize the nutrients in what the babies are fed because medical literature shows it helps babies thrive. Wherever possible, Forsyth said the team emphasized mother's milk.
That is what's best for the premature babies. They tolerate it better, has great antibodies.
Judy Campbell, a lactation consultant, says because of the team's success, calls from mothers with preemies has nearly quadrupled.
We know that mother's milk has growth factors in it, can't be replaced with any other substance.
The team standardized nutrition practices to include fortified donor breast milk for babies whose mothers couldn't provide their own, fortified mother's milk, and formula, depending on each baby's needs. Forsyth says she's pleased with the results so far.
We have been able to put protocols in place so that there's a standardization of care. We've also increased the amount of mother's own milk we've been providing for the babies, which is great.
Riordet says there's a marked improvement in the baby's ability to thrive.
We were able to improve their weight by 30%.
The team isn't quite done. They want to tweak the existing nutrition practices to see if they can improve their results. Once they're finished, they will publish the results so other micropreemies can benefit too. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
It's music time in Africa. Hello, I'm Heather Maxwell. This Sunday, tune into your local radio station, join me, and turn up the volume like you just don't care. I've got an amazing, high-energy lineup of Ethiopian rock, Afro beats, Mande folk, Bonga flavor, classic tuku from Zimbabwe, and more awesome music.
Mommy, work, work, work. Mommy, work, work.
Plus, I sit down and talk with American Ugandan musical duo Shane Palko and Maro. Find out what they're doing in D.C. and hear them perform live and unplugged.
God. So. Well, how old are you? Because you don't look...
I'll be 12 forever, in my opinion.
No, but really, how old are you?
Don't miss it, peeps. Music Time in Africa. This Sunday and the following Saturday at 5 minutes past 15 and 2000 UTC. Oh, yeah.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, a medical charity is calling for the immediate evacuation of all refugees and asylum seekers from Nauru, an end to Australia's controversial offshore detention policy. Staff from Doctors Without Borders were forced to leave the Pacific Island this week, almost a year after the organization began providing mental health services to migrants in an Australian-sponsored camp. For VOA, Phil Messer has more from Sydney.
Nauru's government says it can meet the mental health needs of residents as well as refugees and asylum seekers detained in an Australian-run immigration facility. The camp has been used to hold unauthorised migrants caught trying to reach Australia by boat. On Friday, the Nauru government told Médecins Sans Frontières staff that they had to leave the island. In response, MSF said conditions on the tiny Pacific Republic were beyond desperate. The medical charity says it's concerned for the more than 100 asylum seekers and refugee children on Nauru, citing fears about post-traumatic stress, attempted suicide and self-harm. Paul McFunn is Executive Director at MSF Australia.
We make no mistake, MSF is extremely concerned for the ongoing mental health of all our patients remaining on the island, including asylum seekers and refugees, who remain in a complete state of hopelessness and despair. MSF calls for the immediate evacuation of all asylum seekers and refugees. MSF calls for an end to the Australian policy of indefinite offshore detention.
Nauru is one of two locations in the South Pacific used by Australia to process asylum seekers. The other, on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, closed last October after local judges ruled it unconstitutional because of the poor conditions at the camp. More than 200 detainees are held in Nauru. Under strict border control measures, they won't be allowed to ever resettle in Australia, even if found to be genuine refugees. Australia says it has no intention of closing the facility, despite repeated condemnation from rights groups. Canberra argues that offshore processing is a powerful deterrent for migrants risking their lives at sea, often trying to make the journey on rickety fishing boats from Indonesia. Peter Dutton is Australia's Home Affairs Minister.
I've been very clear before, if I could bring all of those people to Australia tomorrow, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But if I did that, I'd restart boats. And then you'll be asking me about the children who are drowning at sea.
The flow of migrant boats arriving in Australia's territorial waters has stopped. Navy vessels have been ordered to either tow or turn unauthorised boats away. Australia's acceptance of refugees is relatively small compared to other wealthy countries. In 2016, Australia resettled 27,626 people from overseas. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The UN Children's Fund reports a local militia fighting Boko Haram Islamists in northeast Nigeria has released 833 child soldiers. UNICEF says it hopes this action will be followed by further releases. For the UAE, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The local militia that released the children is one of several vigilante militias that formed an alliance in 2013 to fight Boko Haram militants. The UN Children's Fund says last year, this alliance, known as the Civilian Joint Task Force, signed an agreement to end and prevent the recruitment and use of children. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says the 833 child soldiers, some as young as 11, were freed in Maiduguri, northeast Nigeria. He says it marks the first formal release of children since the action plan by the CJTF was signed in September 2017.
So this is a significant milestone in ending the recruitment and use of children, but many more children remain in the ranks of other armed groups in either combat or support roles. We call on all parties to stop recruiting children and let children be children.
Bouyrak notes the children who have been freed are among nearly 1,500 boys and girls recruited by the vigilante militias. But he says UNICEF believes more than 2,000 more children who have not yet been identified are enlisted by other armed groups to support their fight against Boko Haram. The Boko Haram insurgency began in 2009 to topple the government and establish an Islamist state. Over the years, the militant Islamists have killed and kidnapped thousands of people and forced millions to flee their homes and become internally displaced or refugees. Since 2017, UNICEF reports it has helped reintegrate into their communities more than 8,700 children released from armed groups. It says it provides the children with psychosocial support, education, and vocational training so they can earn a living. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Senegal will host the next edition of the Summer Youth Olympic Games in 2022. The International Olympic Committee announced in Buenos Argentina. It will be the first African nation to host the event. Four other African countries, Botswana, Nigeria, Senegal, and Tunisia, were in the running to host the event, but Senegal was chosen as, according to the IOC press release, it provided the best value proposition and the greatest opportunities at this moment in time. Apart from Antarctica, Africa is the only continent in the world have never hosted the Olympic Games. In football, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, last week called off Sierra Leone's back-to-back African Cup of Nations qualifying matches with Ghana. CAF said the matches were cancelled as Sierra Leone did not meet conditions for the lifting of the FIFA-imposed suspension of the country's football association. FIFA acted because of sanctions imposed on Sierra Leone's FIFA president, Isha Johansson, and General Secretary Christopher Kamara. It's not immediately clear if the move means permanent disqualification from the race to Cameroon 2019 for Sierra Leone, or what the consequences are for the other teams in the group, that is Ghana, Ethiopia, and Kenya. Meanwhile, Zambia beat Guinea-Bissau 2-1 in Lusaka, with Ethiopia and Kenya playing out a goalless draw as qualifying for the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations resumed on Wednesday. Zambia's victory over Guinea-Bissau kick-started their hopes of qualifying, bringing Chipolopolo their first victory in Group K. Elsewhere, Liverpool forward Mohamed Salah scored a stunning individual goal to help Egypt beat Eswatini 4-1 in Cairo. Salah took a corner kick on the stroke of halftime and curled it directly into the net to put the Pharaohs 4-0 up going into the break. The result kickstarts Egypt's qualifying campaign, putting them level on points with Group J leaders at Tunisia. Ivory Coast beat Central African Republic 4-0 to revive their Group H campaign. They are now second in the group behind Guinea, who were 2-0 winners over Rwanda, courtesy of a first half Francois Kamano penalty and a goal from Ibrahima Cisse. Africa champions Cameroon edged past Malawi 1-0 to earn Dutch coach Clarence Seedorf his first win in charge of the Indomitable Lions. Cameroon, who qualify for the Nations Cup automatically as hosts, moved 7 points from 3 matches, while Malawi remained on 3 points. The other two sides in Group B are Morocco and Comoros. Togo drew 1-1 with the Gambia in Group D. Group D leaders Algeria moved 3 points clear of Benin thanks to a 2-0 win in Blida. Cape Verde beat Tanzania 3-0 at home to go level on points with Group L leaders Uganda. Gabon got their first win of the Nations Cup qualifying with a comfortable 3-0 victory over South Sudan in Libreville. The win takes Gabon to 4 points in Group C and leaves South Sudan pointless after 3 matches. Mali are top of the group on 7 points, 2 ahead of second place Burundi, who they hosted on Friday night. Angola recovered from going a goal down to beat Mauritania 4-1 in Luanda in Group I clash. Angola now moved 6 points in the group, level with Mauritania after 3 games. All the teams playing on Friday play each other again in the reverse qualifiers on Tuesday, October 16th. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's Wesley Kiror will be the star attraction at the 16th edition of the Blom Bank Beirut Marathon on November 11th, an IAAF Silver Label Road Race. Kiror, a winner of the Boston Marathon in 2012, has not raced since April 2017, but after taking time out from his political career, the 35-year-old is planning to get back to winning ways at next month's race in the Lebanese capital. To succeed, he will have to be at his best with Ethiopia's Bazu Woku, who has a best of 2 hours, 5 minutes and 25 seconds, and was the winner at the Houston Marathon this year, also in the field. Kenyans Ezekiel Omolo and Andrew Ben Kimutai, who have both run below 2:09, are also sure to feature. There will also be a duo of exciting prospects in Uganda's Felix Chemonges and Morocco's Mohamed Ahamami, who bring impressive pedigree at the shorter distances. The women's race is said to be a wide-open contest with an international field spanning several different nationalities. This year's event will also incorporate the 50th World Military Marathon Championship, which will feature 98 runners from almost 20 countries. The Blom Bank Beirut Marathon will also be the first leg of the Asian Premier Marathons, which is now in its second season. And that's about all the time we have for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports.
I will fight for you. Yeah, yeah.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell me if you got me. Tell me if you got me too. Oh. Tell me I don't know why, but me never stop thinking about you. About you. Can we get this thing tied up? Can we get this thing tied up? Know this thing is inside us. Baby, can we get this thing tied up? Can we get this thing tied up? No, you know this thing is inside us. Baby, can we get this?
We are going to get up.
Inside us. Oh, 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 oh. Baby, can we get it?
ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Professor Jay.
Nipo sana, leo juzi na jana, wanaokuambia we mkali wanakudanganya. Sikiza hizi mambo mambo vile watu fanya ni ngumu ngumu kumeza watu wote jicho nyanya. Na wakusanya na nafanya na chofanya jita, piga gita mithili ya Santana. Mtaa unaongea so pop pop tuvute, Freak Mandela so don't stop to ruke. Biti na washa, tadhani na piri piri, watu wana amsha, tadhani makiri kiri. Salam kwao, salam kwao, mtawa piru, kishindwa tingisha kichwa, tingisha kiwiri wiri. Shida zimumbo kwetu kwa nini zikutese, koma nazo zikikushinda joe tukeshe. Be happy wanangu, funja mifupa, haina kuferi na kesho tunaza upya. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa, kama meno ipo. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa, kama meno ipo. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa, kama meno ipo. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa. Sometimes nakula bata tadhani na blink hella. Sometimes issues otata michongo kwenye mesela. Kama unaweza fata ubegwe kwenye machela. Hapo meliwa mekula ndo zetu kisela sela. Karia yangu ya mde mrefu sedia umre yang D. Sishi kwa kuza sula kwa kuwa na plan B. Kwenye mapenzi ya dhati chongo naliona kengeza. Hesabu ulicho nacho sahau ulicho poteza. Wana kupaka pili pili we unawapaka wanja. Watu wacha kufanya diri fikiri kabla kuanza. No doubt master the sale for real hizi ndo stanza. Misio wa makirikiri na upadiri dogo janja. Maisha ncheche ncheche niache niseme. Kama umesha likoroga limeze ama liteme. Ukintupia uchawi ngoma ngumu kama msoto. Mbeba chuma ukijidai na kuchapa kwa nekabra. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa, kama meno ipo. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa, kama meno ipo. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa, kama meno ipo. Funja mifupa, funja mifupa, funja mifupa.
Cause you want my love, oh, ah, yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Mr. Peak Botha, the veteran diplomat of apartheid South Africa, died last Friday at his home outside of Pretoria. He was 86 years old. Mr. Botha served as foreign minister for 17 years, and he was the polite and smiling face of apartheid South Africa. He was the representative also at the United Nations, and during that time, he was snubbed by many of the African delegates because of his defense of apartheid. He, however, was most insistent that he was just as an African as any of the African delegates, although a white man and representing the apartheid regime. He was always trying to break through the resistance of the outside world to apartheid South Africa, particularly at a time when sanctions were being applied against South Africa. He was trying always to see whether he could breach these sanctions to make South Africa acceptable. Because of my role as a principal political advisor under two secretary generals, in particular Pierre de Quer and Boutros Ghali, I was obliged to interact with Mr. Porter in tackling a number of pressing African problems such as in Zimbabwe, Namibia, and Mozambique, and South Africa itself. It became very clear to me that this man, who was the first defender of apartheid, really was not convinced about the viability of the apartheid system. He came to a point where he went public, saying there would soon come a time when there would be a black African president of South Africa. He was forced to recant, which he did. But I found him also very helpful in resolving two key problems in which I participated. I could recall the case of Mozambique, where FINAMO and FINAMO were negotiating in Rome. The negotiations came to an end, and there was a time to sign it. Suddenly, Mr. Alfonso da Clama refused to sign the document. I was dispatched to go to Rome to see what help I could render. Having had discussion with President Joaquin Chissano, I then went to see Mr. Alfonso in his hotel in Rome. On my arrival, I met with Mr. Botta. We exchanged discussion, and he told me he was trying to convince da Clama to sign. When I went in to see da Clama for the first time, we discussed and also referred to the meeting he just had with Mr. Botta. At the end, he agreed to sign the document. The document was signed in Rome in October in 1992, thus bringing to an end the 16-year civil war in Mozambique. Equally, in dealing with South Africa itself, the United Nations was giving an observer role in the negotiations inside South Africa, but the government of South Africa refused to give a pivotal role to the United Nations, which was being demanded by the ANC under Nelson Mandela. And then suddenly, under the good offices of Nigeria, the Secretary General Boutros Boutros Ghali and I were invited to go to Nigeria to meet Mr. Botta and Chief Buthelezi. In those discussions, which were very difficult and bitter, came to an end when Mr. Botta turned towards me and said, "For us to change, we need a gesture from the United Nations," meaning that we are too biased since we have observer status for the ANC and others. This led us to propose to the summit meeting in Dakar in 1992 that the OAU should recommend a meeting of the Security Council to which the so-called Bantustan's representatives will be sent, not as sovereign states, but to provide information to the Council. Though some members of the OAU were skeptical, Dr. Salim Salim pressed them to accept it, and the Council meeting met with some of the Bantustans representing, and this led South Africa to accept a critical role of the UN in the transition in South Africa. So Piet Botta has been a tragic figure in the sense that he knew he was working for a regime that was not sustainable. But as South African, he continued. He later joined the government of Mandela under the transition period and was the Minister of Energy, and later had to withdraw when his party withdrew from the coalition. He will certainly be missed by many South Africans who came to know him after the end of the apartheid regime. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wen, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, the darkness of the night cannot stop the light of the morning. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.